Welcome to the Mind-Muscle Connection Podcast, a show that is dedicated to educating you on applying science-based training, nutrition, and mindset strategies from some of the top minds in the industry to help you build a leaner, stronger, and more confident self. I'm your host, Jeff Hain. Let's dive in. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Mind Muscle Connection Podcast. Today I have a very special guest, Dr. Alan Flanagan. He has a PhD in nutrition from the University of Surrey, where his doctoral research focused on Surrey. I told you I was going to get it wrong. Where his doctoral research focused on circadian rhythms, feeding, and chrononutrition. So welcome on, and looking forward to chatting with you today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Jeff. Looking forward to chat.
It's funny. I told you off air. I was like, all right, I'm going to ask you how to say it. And then I knew once we got rolling with it, you know, once you hit record, everything changes. So, but yeah, looking forward to chatting with you today. And so just to kind of start off, you know, with all my new guests, I just kind of like to just go over a little, maybe a brief background. So maybe I hit a little bit on it in the introduction, but, you know, maybe just kind of go over what you do and whatnot in this industry. And we'll go from there.
Yeah. So I would kind of envisage my role broadly as education and science communication, although I don't really like the latter term. I think, you know, essentially what I do is I am and have been in academic research. I'm now between projects. I'm going to stay in academia just because I love actually being actively involved in research. And then I run an online education hub, which is Alinea Nutrition, and that's aimed at healthcare professionals. So I use that term broadly. We have a lot of nutritionists, dietitians, medical professionals, strength and conditioning coaches, or PTs, but it's an in-depth research review, which is also geared at getting people's kind of critical literacy and their actual understanding of what goes on in research, like jacked up a bit, which I think just makes the conversation all a bit better when we're having these kind of, you know, debates online. And then I also work with Danny Lennon with Sigma Nutrition, where we produce the Sigma Nutrition Radio podcast. And that's, you know, something that allows us quite a wide reach in terms of both the academics that Sigma Nutrition brings on and then also the podcast episodes we do on specific topics. So a lot of what I do has this public facing component. And I do think it is important that we're taking in an era of, you know, just rampant misinformation about diet and about the abuse of science. So part of why I don't like the term science communication is because someone would say, well, that's what the carnivore MD does. Like, no, that's abusing science for, you know, largely a commercial agenda. So I think it's important that we kind of upskill our understanding of research, our ability to break down and critique research. And I think overall that will just kind of have us in a lot better position to then empower clients if people work with people one-to-one, or even just to empower yourself to be able to know what's bullshit and what's not.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. You guys do a great job at Sigma Nutrition. Anytime I have any questions on anything nutrition related, I always, you know, want to get your guys' opinion on it because I think you do a great job of, you know, breaking down, you know, what the research actually says rather than, you know, again, maybe you hear it from some sort of doctor online and it's just like, is that 100% accurate? And like you said, in today's world, it's so easy to, there's so much information and it's like, you know, what is good information and what's not. And also, like you said, just kind of, I guess people misunderstand the science of everything as well too, right? And, you know, maybe they misapply the studies. And so you guys do a great job of breaking that down. And it seems like that's, you know, what you really try to work on the most. So I guess a couple questions off that. Do you do any like coaching or anything like that? And then two, are you involved in any like research or have been or anything like that?
So one, I don't, and that's deliberate. I don't really enjoy the kind of one-to-one client facing stuff. I do, you know, I've always kind of enjoyed more the research side. I do some one-to-one kind of consultation work, which is not like working with someone on their diet. That's usually with like, you know, a nutritionist, for example, or a trainer who works with people and they've got a client with a certain, you know, they've got a client who's got PCOS and they're like, okay, what does the research actually show? And we hop on a call and we go through that evidence. And so it's just about getting them straight on what the research actually shows and then how they're going to translate that to their client. So in that sense, but I don't do any kind of actual nutrition coaching or anything like that. And that, honestly, that's just not my skill set. There's people that are really good at that. I kind of like, I'm kind of one step back. That's kind of how I see it. So it's like, I'll take kind of my approach to the research and then digest that for people that actually do the kind of one-to-one work. So as far as my own research goes, my PhD was focused broadly on timing of food intake and how that might influence health. And my MSc research was looking at night shift workers. They were nurses in this case, and how that changed their pattern of energy intake across the day. And we also had data on their families. So those papers are published. PhD research papers are both at the kind of final stages just before we're going to submit them for publication. And then right now, I'm just kind of having a few conversations with some mentors and other academics about what kind of project I'd like to get involved next. Partly because I have kind of, with the PhD research, I want to move away from chrononutrition. Not that it's not an interesting space, but I think it's, if you want to stay in research, I think it's good to broaden horizons. So I'd be aiming to kind of get more involved in something kind of more on the real nutrition metabolism side of things.
Awesome. Yeah. So it sounds like with the coaching, it's like more indirectly you work with people, right? You're helping coaches out and practitioners, you know, with the research and whatnot. So that's awesome. So it's like not directly, but indirectly working with people. And then as far as the research goes, you've done like meal timing, chrononutrition, and then now you're looking at, you know, expanding out a little bit there into other aspects. Basically. So you said mostly metabolism is what you're looking at.
Yeah, I'm kind of still quite interested in cardiovascular disease. That would probably be the disease or the health condition that I'm most interested in. And we do know a lot about diet and heart disease, generally cardiovascular disease, but there's still some kind of stones that haven't quite been, you know, overturned. And one thing about nutrition that we do know is that there's huge inter-individual variation from one person to the next. Yet most of our recommendations are based on averages. Most of our recommendations are broad population based. But we know that there's a lot of, you know, someone's genetic predisposition or their ethnic ancestry or any of these things, sex, age, all of these categorical factors influence someone's response to nutrition. And I think that there's some interesting things there that potentially, if we start looking at it through the lens of variation from person to person. So a big interest in mine is, for example, why are some people really responsive to dietary cholesterol intake and some people aren't? Why are some people more responsive to saturated fats and some people aren't? And I think that there's some interesting stuff there from a cardiovascular health perspective to still kind of tease out. So I'd like to look at something related to that.
Awesome. Yeah. Looking forward to that. And I know kind of like you said, that's, you know, with the science aspect of it, I think that's probably where a lot of people go wrong with it, right? Is they think that that's what we find in the research is, you know, that's applied for everybody, but it's just kind of the, you know, generalities. And again, from there, it's like, you have to kind of, you know, look at what the studies actually say, and then how can you apply that to different people? Because like you said, there is just so much variation from person to person with it that, you know, it's important to, I think, understand that. And like I said, you do a great job of breaking that down. So
awesome.
Cool. Well, let's dive into the next part here, the, current training and nutrition. I always like to ask, you know, new guests, you know, what they do. So what are some of your goals? I've listened to, like I said, you on Sigma Nutrition. I don't think I've ever really heard you talk about it. So I'm curious to hear, you know, what you kind of do from this standpoint, like what your goals are with it.
Yeah, I don't talk about it much anymore just because it didn't make sense for the way certainly my social media was growing, you know, but I've always been certainly, you know, I guess I was one of those guys who got into strength training at quite a young age, played rugby in school, took it quite seriously. So obviously started strength training for that, you know, when I was kind of 14, 15, but I kind of developed a separate love for strength training, almost independent of rugby. And then I stopped playing rugby about 7, maybe 8 years ago. And then you're kind of at a crossroads for about a year or two. I just generally trained with no specific outcome other than being, you know, in good shape and and generally strong. But I started to get bored. CrossFit was exploding at the time. I had some friends taking that up, but it never quite appealed to me. So I did a powerlifting meet purely out of interest. And I loved it. So I've been powerlifting pretty much ever since. So the last 8 years, that's been my main activity. And it's a great sport, a lot of enjoyment, and good way to clear the head. And my diet, it's funny because I guess through certainly my 20s, I would have been a lot more anal about all of the nutrition aspects. And I think there's like a knowledge threshold that happens with nutrition where once you kind of know enough, you start to realize that a lot of the small details you were hung up on that you think really matter probably don't matter. So I'm at a point now where, you know, I don't track anything anymore. I don't think about energy intake I eat, and I know that I eat enough. And I would say that I have a radar in my brain, there's a radar in my brain for protein. So I know that I am always aiming to get enough protein at a meal, but outside of that, I couldn't tell you what, you know, how many carbs or fats I eat. I couldn't tell you. I kind of eat the same, relatively speaking, if I work from home a lot. So you kind of get into a routine with that. So yeah, I mean, I compete in the under 93 category, and I kind of walk around at like 95-ish. That'll probably go up to like 97 after Christmas. But I'm within that touching distance, you know. So it's easy for me then, you know, 2 or 3 weeks out from a meet to just start thinking about and it's making wages never a problem. So yeah, that's the thing. And I don't see myself not powerlifting anytime soon. You know, some shitty injury, touch wood aside. I just really get a lot out of that. It's the maximal strength component that I typically just enjoy trying to push that. I've never been great with anything endurance related or otherwise, so I'll stick to power.
Yeah, no cardio. Just making sure you lift the weights. So you said basically, mm-hmm. it sounds like you just kind of like sit around 95 for most of the year, and then like you said, maybe it comes up a little bit, and then just kind of run a cut or whatever, I guess, before. Do you ever try to like move your body weight past that or up or anything more? Or do you just find that sitting around there is where you're most comfortable and whatnot?
So I have moved it up. Like after I stopped playing, I lost a good bit of weight, probably in the region of like 10 kilos. And mostly that was because I was done playing for the first time in my life, I could get really lean. And I really wanted to get really lean. And I really enjoyed the process of getting lean. I really liked some people struggle, obviously. I was kind of, I think, one of those people who I probably just have good appetite control. And I didn't really find myself ever that hungry. I know some people are more susceptible to the perception of hunger, you know, if they're restricting energy intake and kind of dieting for a period of time. So I was always, for whatever reason, like slightly more resilient to those signals. And I really enjoyed the process. And I would generally try and maintain at a relatively lean kind of constant for a couple of years. But then the problem was, so I'm like 183 flat on the nose. And so height-wise, in terms of weight to power ratio, that kind of puts me in this gray area. So my first couple of powerlifting meets, I did in like the under 83s, which in hindsight was wild because I looked like I was waking up for a meet and I was shredded, but I was weak as shit.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, it wasn't working out well. So I was always losing some performance on the day. And then I just thought, you know what, I'll just kind of eat my way up to like a lighter 93 or like a 93 that sits around kind of that. So yeah, I kind of gained over a 2 year period. I kind of gained back from about kind of 85 kind of up to back. Yeah. So another 10 kilos back around. But I like where I'm at now because I do have that really, I've kind of a better, you know, power to weight ratio now. And I also don't have to necessarily do anything like drastic to be, you know, weigh in at, I don't know, 92.6 or something like that on the day. So that's the easy part.
Yeah. So it sounds like for you, then it was, you did it, you were at 83 kilos and, but you found that like, yeah, you were shredded, but it's like performance suffered. You weren't doing as well. And it sounds like that was a little bit tougher to maintain for you. Whereas like now this like 95 is easier for you to maintain. And then it's relatively easy cut for you to get down to, you said 90, like 92.6 or something like that. And I'm assuming performance and everything like that's improved with that as well.
Exactly. Too. Yeah. Performance is there. And also, yeah, I don't need to do anything really that crazy with my diet. So I'm able to maintain strength. I seem to get a lot. I know the research in this area is not great, but I seem to get a lot out of water loading and doing like a water load and a cut. I've always just seemed to have some sort of response to that where I really am like expelling a lot of water when I kind of cut it off, and I have a pretty high water intake anyway. So if I, you know, I can sometimes just do that. And maybe on the day before weigh-in, just not really have much like solid like food, like eat kind of a couple of liquid and I haven't had to cut carbs or anything like that. And so yeah, performance wise, it's always kind of a lot better on the day, and you just feel a lot better. Whereas yeah, like sometimes I was weighing in at like 82.8, but like I'd start warming up for squats, and I'd be like, this is going to be a long day.
You knew right away that it was going to be.
Yeah. You just felt everything was moving. Even your warmups were like fucking slow. It's like,
do you foresee yourself like changing this body weight that you kind of sit around in the near future? Like if you decide, hey, maybe I'm not going to power lift, I might try to go a little bit lower or maybe higher. Or do you find that this is probably going to be a body weight that you'll stay at?
Yeah, I enjoy being at this weight. Like I don't have to really think about much. My diet's fairly just kind of automated, essentially. Like I'm lean enough that I'm not like compromising my health in any way, because that was always the old like powerlifter meme, right? You know, it's just like guys using the sport as an excuse to eat jellies and cheeseburgers. And I think that phenotype is a thing of the past now. I think it's you know, people realize the benefit and actually having a good, like, you know, power to weight ratio and stuff like that. But yeah, I am just, I like that my enjoyment of training and my ability to make progress and all of that doesn't now occupy any headspace, essentially. Whereas, again, you know, when I was kind of leaner, and I didn't mind at the time because it was just kind of part of what I was enjoying about it. But there's a lot of mental energy that you're expending on like setting up your diet and making sure you're prepped and executing and training. And now I just don't want to expend that mental energy on, you know, doing something that I actually just enjoy because I enjoy it. So yeah, I think I'll just stay in cruise control for the foreseeable.
Awesome. Yeah. No, I just curious to hear if that, you know, maybe it's more so, hey, I'm staying here because of powerlifting, or if, you know, maybe at some point when you know, if you ever do switch out of powerlifting, if that's going to change. But I'm sure you'll cross that bridge whenever you get there, if and when that happens. So cool, Alan. Well, super interesting to hear, you know, about your background and training and everything like that. So let's dive into the topic. I do want to first talk about the concept of social jet lag. This is just something that I haven't talked about on here before. And as I learn more about chrononutrition, circadian rhythms in general, I just find that this is probably something that a lot of people struggle with and they don't even realize it. So if we can maybe dive into this a little bit, so maybe what is it? And we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because as a concept, it very much comes from chronobiology rather than nutrition. And any chronobiologist, like one of whom I'm working on a paper that was part of my PhD, where we looked at social jet lag and how it related to kind of when people were eating and how they distributed their energy. And it's interesting hearing people like her, she's worked with the research group who coined this term, talk about it, because they're even still hesitant as to what exactly it represents. So I'll explain to people what it is conceptually first, and then we can kind of like come back to that. So social jet lag is a concept. Everyone probably listening has experienced some degree of jet lag. So you've flown from East Coast to West Coast, and the timing of your light exposure, of your sleep-wake cycle, of your behaviors is now off by, you know, say 4 hours. Or you've flown from, you know, the West Coast of the US to London, and in which case you're massively off now. So with jet lag, what we've got is a situation where the behaviors that you have in your current time zone, you go to bed at a certain time, you wake up at a certain time, you eat breakfast at 8:30 a.m., and your body synchronizes to the clock time that you're doing these behaviors at. So normal jet lag, you are offset from that by however many hours you've traveled east or west, and your body essentially has to catch up. But with jet lag, that is generally transient. As you spend time in your new time zone, your body will synchronize to the timing of that new time zone. With social jet lag, this is describing a situation where, for example, because of maybe work commitments or because of a commute, or they need to get kids up for school, because of environmental factors, someone might have a sleep-wake cycle preference, a personal preference, let's just say, for listeners to kind of get a picture in their head here, of say midnight to 8 a.m. That might be their ideal sleep, 8 hour sleep wake cycle. And if we left them alone with no alarm clocks, no kids, no anything like that, that would be how they would self-select to go to bed, right? Social jet lag describes when environmental factors might have that person be waking up at 5 a.m. And so as a result, we know that people that have a preference for a certain sleep-wake cycle, they don't tend to try to go to bed earlier just because they're not tired. So they tend to go to bed at the same time. But now, instead of waking up at 8 and having their square 8 hours of sleep, they're now waking up at 5, which is in the middle of their biological night. So one way that you could conceptualize this is if they slept from midnight to 8 a.m., then 4 a.m. would be their midpoint of sleep. It would be the middle point of that sleep. But if they slept from midnight to 5 a.m., it would be 2:30. So what you would do is you would add up, you would determine the average that their midpoint of sleep was when they had forced wake-up times, compared to what their preferred midpoint of sleep would be if they were left to their own devices. And we would express this in hours per week. So it could be, for example, that someone has only an hour of social jet lag, but they could have 2, 3, 4, 5, depending on how disconnected they are with factors. So this was termed social jet lag. They're not traveling anywhere, but they're experiencing this constantly changing timing of their behaviors because of society, because of our social clocks and otherwise. And there was a paper probably around 2012 was the first to look at the associations between obesity and social jet lag levels. And it found that once you were over about 2 hours, you could really see this increase in the odds for people having obesity. Then there was another paper that came out that looked at metabolic risk factors. So people's triglycerides, their glucose intolerance, and found that, again, once you were over 2 hours, but particularly people with 3 hours a week of social jet lag had like a 60% higher odds of having metabolic syndrome criteria. So there's a question over what does this actually represent? Is it the same type of thing that we would see with shift workers, where they're constantly just shifting from one cycle, one shift to the next? And put it this way, that the best analogy for the circadian system is it's an anticipatory system. It likes consistency. It likes routine. And it's like having an orchestra composed of different musical instruments, where the instruments are capable of playing at different times, But if they don't follow the music, it's going to sound like shit. And so that's kind of what's happening internally. If someone's never getting the opportunity to be consistent, then all of their instruments internally are completely playing out of time, out of tune. And we think that that's something that might increase someone's risk of metabolic disease, maybe cardiovascular disease. But whether social jet lag represents a kind of similar type of effect as shift work, or whether it's just this effect of the disconnect in their sleep-wake timing, that's the part that's still a bit of an open question.
Awesome. Yeah. So I guess kind of how you described it was like somebody that is going to sleep from like 12 to 8. And then they basically, you know, maybe they have to wake up at 5 a.m. like you said, or something like that. And then that would count like towards like 3 hours of social jet lag time. So again, that's somebody that, you know, you get less sleep during certain days throughout the week and whatnot. But also, could you consider social jet lag too, where like, hey, maybe like during the week, it's like, hey, we go to bed at 10, wake up at 6 a.m. Then on the weekends, you go to bed at like 12 a.m. or 1 a.m. And then you wake up at, you know, 7 or 8 or something like that. Can that also be considered social jet lag?
Okay. Yes. So it goes both ways. Now, social jet lag, there's another important concept to introduce, which is this idea of your chronotype. So that's your internal biological preference. It's largely genetic. It's your internal biological preference for time of day. And that's what social jet lag uses. It uses your midpoint of sleep as a proxy for your chronotype. So colloquially, we would call chronotypes like morning larks or night owls. Most people are actually somewhere in the middle. Most people are just kind of intermediate types. But because of artificial light in our societies, there's now a greater proportion of later chronotypes than there were like 20 years ago, 30 years ago. For late chronotypes, because they will go to bed later, that scenario I described, let's say, would be a late chronotype. So they're disrupted and they get social jet lag is created in them because they have an early wake time, but they're a late chronotype. But social jet lag can also impact people that are early chronotypes. And that's typically to do with the way that people socialize rather than the way that people work. So late chronotypes tend to get sleep debt during the working week because they've got to get kids up for school or they've got to get up for a commute or something like that. But early chronotypes tend to be prone to social jet lag because of social occasions on weekends. So they're the ones during the working week, they're tucked in bed at 9:30, 10 p.m. Great. They may even wake up naturally at 5 or 5:36 and they feel great. They get on with their day. And then Friday night comes and it's a friend's birthday dinner. And now they're like eating at 8 and they're out till 2 and they get home. And then so they're a bit, you know, knocked out of whack the next day. So that is something that will as well create social jet lag, and generally that is early chronotypes that are prone to that kind of disruption with people's, you know, kind of more, we as a society we typically have quite nocturnal socializing habits, so yes, people will get social jet lag in that kind of circumstance.
Awesome. Yeah, so again, it sounds like people that wake up early, you know, they're the ones that are going to see that social jet lag on like the weekends when they have social events, whereas people who like to wake up later, they're the ones that are going to see it during the week.
Yes.
Cool. So I guess then on that, a couple questions, I guess. So what happens in this scenario? Like, is there anything from like a metabolic standpoint that we need to know about, or like an appetite standpoint or anything like that can happen with social jet lag?
Yeah, so this is the part that we're still really trying to tease out. The research to date is almost all observational. There's no intervention trials that have looked specifically at social jet lag. We do have studies, a lot of very kind of tightly controlled studies, you know, conducted in a laboratory where they've looked at circadian misalignment. And so if we're going to use those studies as a kind of potential explanation for what might be going on, we do know that circadian misalignment does result in impaired glucose tolerance. That effect can occur in people that are absolutely otherwise healthy, lean, young adults that are otherwise insulin sensitive. So we do know that probably the most consistent effect appears to relate to insulin sensitivity and glucose tolerance, and the ability of insulin to actually respond to a given level of glucose in the blood. So that's one probably prime candidate, I would say, that would explain some of the adverse metabolic effects that we see in the observational research. Because in those studies that have looked at metabolic outcomes, some cross-sectional study have typically showed impaired glucose tolerance as well. So that's probably the lowest hanging fruit that we could think might explain some of these effects. There's also the potential for appetite to be impacted. There's evidence of, for example, like later eating typically leading to higher hunger levels the next day, which is counterintuitive because, well, they're eating the same amount as someone with earlier meals. So why are they hungrier the next day? But there is this elevation in hunger that has been shown again in a couple of recent very, very well executed intervention trials. So possibly an appetite effect. Then we also know from sleep curtailment research, and this is not even factoring in circadian misalignment, but a lot of studies that have looked at the effects of, say, 5 hours sleep a night show, again, impaired glucose tolerance, effects on appetite, but people typically overconsume energy following a period of sleep curtailment. And often that increase in calorie intake can be up to like 22% higher. And they have higher levels of hunger hormones, they have higher subjective hunger. So I think if I was forming a hypothesis to run an intervention trial looking at the effects of social jet lag, for example, I think what I would be thinking was glucose intolerance would be the main culprit. And then I would also be thinking that potentially dysregulated appetite and then compensatory energy or calorie intake would also be a factor. And of course, if you're eating more calories after a period of feeling sluggish and sleep restriction, you know, and you're glucose intolerant, like those are not going to go well together.
Yeah. So it sounds like, you know, again, it's probably a combination of those two there that are causing it. And so, or at least playing a role in that. So from like a glucose intolerance standpoint, you know, say somebody is, you know, they track their calories, macros, they stay on top of it. You know, they're focused on body composition. For somebody like that, you know, how, even though they might be hitting their, you know, their nutrition goals, you know, how would that potentially impact, you know, their body composition, you know, if that was them?
So that again is also difficult to know. One study that does come to mind wasn't necessarily looking at social jet lag, but was looking at sleep curtailment. And they compared a group in the context of weight loss, kind of hypocaloric diet. They compared a group sleeping 8 hours a night and a group sleeping 5 hours a night. And they looked at body composition changes. And what was frightening was the amount of lean mass that the group sleeping 5 hours a night lost. So I think that for people that are body composition focused and work hard for their lean mass, the idea of, you know, shortchanging sleep probably is fairly counterproductive to that goal. And, you know, and again, the mechanisms might be still a bit debated, but one idea would be that in that kind of state, the body shifts into almost like a kind of a hoarding kind of phase. It's holding on to fat mass and it's deciding that lean mass is metabolically costly. This tissue can go. So yeah, that's the kind of theory, but certainly we have that, you know, human intervention trial that showed that. So I would be conscious of this if I was someone that was particularly focused on body composition. To what extent that relates to social jet lag, I don't know, but it's certainly there in the sleep curtailment literature.
Right. Yeah. So it's, you know, you can't say for sure that that's what it is, but obviously, you know, not getting enough sleep is going to potentially affect your body composition, especially the lean body mass. Yeah. That study is definitely super, super interesting. I bring that one up all the time because, again, it's like, I'm pretty sure in that study they lost the same amount of weight, but it was like, again, the lean body mass loss was right. A lot more for that group.
Yeah, I think they both lost in the region of like 8 kilos or something in the region of kind of 5 to 8% of their starting body weight, but like 75% of that was lean mass loss in the sleep curtailed group, which is a lot of lean mass to be giving up.
Yeah. And, you know, that's, it's unfortunate because, you know, again, like in this situation, it's like, you know, people, obviously they want to improve their health, but then it's also like, hey, they want to enjoy life. And so it's like, you know, at what point, you know, do you decide here? Do I just sleep a little, you know, do I go to bed later, get less sleep, or do I focus on my social life? You know? So I guess it's that, you know, you just kind of have to ask yourself, you know, what's more important there and whatnot. And I do want to get into some practical mm-hmm. applications so we can chat about that. One thing you mentioned too, was like, the appetite aspect of it. I am aware. I was somebody brought this study up to me, and so I don't know if you're familiar with it, but they talked about leptin, right? They looked at leptin levels, and I think it's from Shear et al. In 2009. I'm not sure if you're aware of that.
I know. Well, yeah, yeah.
Okay, cool. So they talked about leptin, and from my understanding, is like leptin was just out of whack when they changed their sleep pattern. So maybe you could hit on that and maybe explain that study a little bit more.
Yeah, so that study is kind of one of the most cited in chrononutrition and kind of circadian nutrition related research. And basically, what they did with that study is a full 12-hour inversion of people's light and behavior. So this would be kind of equivalent to flying from probably where you are in Missouri to say Sydney. You know, this kind of extreme form of the maximal, because we only have 24-hour days, this is the maximal flip in the timing of your behaviors right. that a human can do. So it's a really interesting study to tease out some of the mechanisms and what exactly is truly circadian in metabolism and what might be influenced by the behavioral cycle. What they showed was separate effects of the circadian and behavioral cycle. And one of their effects, in addition to the kind of impact on glucose tolerance and insulin sensitivity, was that leptin was out of whack, was out of sync. And typically what we would expect to see with leptin is actually a rise in objective measures of energy and appetite regulatory hormones that are impacted by misalignment. Studies that have used subjective measures of appetite have also showed that there is a circadian rhythm. And actually it was Frank Skier's group at Harvard that also showed this in another study where they were looking at rhythms in subjective appetite and found that they typically would peak in the evening. If we're talking about clock time, it's around 7 p.m. for our kind of clock time. But what's interesting is that the timing of an individual's food intake, and this again has been shown quite recently in a number of really really tightly controlled studies. Even though we seem to have a natural peak in subjective hunger in the evening, if people front load energy intake earlier in the day, that is typically attenuated and there's greater appetite regulation and kind of enhanced appetite control with that pattern of energy intake early in the day. So I do think when we look at that research, the changes that occur in energy balance and appetite regulatory hormones are probably a factor that explain the kind of compensatory increase in energy intake we see. We also typically see preferentially people are looking to more energy dense foods. They're looking to foods that are richer in kind of carbohydrate and fat. Their what we would call their hedonic appetite, their appetite for quick hit, you know, fast energy is increased in their brain is kind of like a homing pigeon now for hyper palatable energy dense foods. So again, there's a lot of converging that's going to mean that certainly someone constantly experiencing you know, some degree of sleep curtailment, you know, adding to their social jet lag is likely going to be, you know, trying to put out a lot of these fires on multiple fronts.
Well, yeah. And with leptin too, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong here. Does leptin play a role in like energy expenditure at all as well too? And if it does, is it just a small degree or yeah?
It's related to overall energy balance. I mean, it's one of our primary energy balance hormones. It's not necessarily directly involved in energy expenditure. The biggest components of energy expenditure are resting or basal metabolic rate, the amount of energy we need just to be alive and blinking, and then our physical activity energy expenditure. And then the small bit of increased energy expenditure that we get from actually having to digest food or thermic effective feeding. That's probably not a very important component overall. There used to be a lot of focus that you could like manipulate the thermic effect of feeding and that might enhance weight loss. And we really just don't think that's the case anymore. So, but leptin, if we think about the relationship it has with energy expenditure and overall energy balance, we know that leptin obviously is secreted by fat tissue. As individuals become increasingly leaner or lose body mass, that signal to in terms of leptin, obviously leptin drops in that context. Generally, the feedback loop is that the hypothalamus picks up on this decline and increases appetite and food-seeking behavior because the brain is now going, why are we losing mass? You know, we're just an organism trying to survive. But obviously, in the course of someone who, you know, goes from, say, weighing 90 kilos to weighing 80 kilos, there's also going to be, because they are now a lighter person, they now have lost body mass, their resting metabolic rate will adapt to their new weight. So there'll be a relationship overall in this picture. The most variable component of all of this is physical activity, energy expenditure. And that's probably why, you know, people who are successful in weight loss maintenance tend to be those that are like most active and maintain high levels of exercise and non-exercise activity. But as far as leptin goes, I think overall the hypothesized role for leptin is really how it relates to the communication of energy balance information to the brain and how that then might relate to food seeking behaviors. But of course, one of the big aspects to this is we know it's not really the full story. You know, the leptin gene was discovered in 1994 and everyone thought, great, this is the solution. We've got it. We just need to make leptin injections and we're flying. And it turns out the only people that leptin injections will work in are people with a congenital leptin deficiency, a genetic deficiency. So leptin's fascinating, but it clearly, human appetite regulation and energy balance regulation is so complex that it definitely goes way beyond leptin. But certainly if we do see these changes in energy balance, appetite regulatory hormones, we would typically make an inference that it might be something that impacts on overall appetite. But the research in that area is really poor.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's going to be more indirect. And then again, it's like you said, just very complex. There's so many different things going on in terms of, you know, again, appetite and energy expenditure and whatnot. So cool. So I guess, I know you made this post and I think this kind of they relate to each other. I think it was like March 17th was about, can you make up sleep? So like, if you're in this situation, you know, like say during the week, you're not getting enough sleep or anything like that, can you make up for sleep on the weekends by just sleeping, you know, an extra couple, 2 to 3 hours or sleeping in or anything like that?
Yeah, this obviously is something that most people probably want to hear. The idea that, well, look, if I have some sleep debt, if I have some social jet lag, can I sleep in on the weekend? And will that bring me back, so to speak? Will that reset? This was a really fascinating study. It was a laboratory study. Patients maintained, lived in a lab for a 14-day period, and they had some participants who were sleeping 9 hours a night, so they were the control group. Then they had a sleep restriction group that had just 5 hours a night sleep straight, so they didn't change that pattern of their sleep, but it was sleep restricted. Then they had a group who also did the 5 hours a night sleep, but mimicking, say, a working week. And then they were allowed to actually pick themselves, to self-select on a weekend in the lab for how long they slept for. So they were just allowed to sleep as much as they want. And then they repeated the kind of sleep restriction and they did the extended sleep recovery then again. What was really interesting was that some of the outcomes almost across the board were worse essentially in the weekend recovery sleep group. And so one of the potential reasons for this is because even in the sleep restriction, they're still having some degree of consistency. Whereas the weekend recovery sleep group were basically knocking themselves out of whack. So again, it goes back to this idea. This is a very much a social jet lag concept, this study, and how we wouldn't think about this study, I think, is because they're basically just bouncing from one set of, you know, consistent behavior timing to the weekend sleep and then back to it. And so what was interesting was that, yes, there were, just to be clear, the sleep restriction group did have negative impacts on multiple outcomes, energy intake. They consume more. They consume more total daily energy intake. They had impaired insulin sensitivity. But all of those outcomes were worse in the weekend recovery sleep group. So this is a finding that was probably counterintuitive. I think people would have hypothesized that the weekend recovery sleep kind of reset people in that group, and it didn't at all. So it's a really interesting finding, and I think it really, you know, suggests that even just sleeping in on weekends would not be enough to just put yourself back on track, even if you're allowed to sleep as much as you want to. So it really speaks to the importance of actually trying to maintain not just good sleep duration and quality, but trying to maintain that as much as possible.
Yeah, that's, like you said, that's not what people want to hear. And that's probably very disappointing to hear that, yeah. That, you know, even
devastating.
Even if you try to make up that sleep on the week, because I mean, it's, you know, I do that, right? Where it's like on the weekend, I might sleep in and, you know, a little bit extra. And it's like, man, that's, you know, really unfortunate to hear, because it's, you know, on the weekend, it's hard to be like, oh, hey, let's wake up early now, because, you know, I don't want to mess this up. So I guess with that, like, is there any, in terms of the consistency, you know, is it like, are we talking an hour or two, or does that matter? Or yeah.
So one of the things that I do think is, I think important probably for people to note is, because we do have a lot of this, 8 hours sleep a night is ideal. And that's not necessarily wrong. But what's missing in this picture is an assumption that like earlier is better, or there's a certain set time, clock time at which people have to go to bed. Really, what I think most of the research starts to point out more is that the more that someone can kind of live attuned to their own preferences, and everyone knows really what that is. People know if they're a morning person, they know if they're a night owl. People, because this is genetic and it's a strong behavior drive that comes from your internal biology. So people kind of know what they are as far as their preferred biological time, their preferred behavioral timing, as far as when they sleep, when they wake, when they train, when they like to be active, and all of that. So I think probably now the best advice we can give in this area is, as much as someone can, try to have their timing as close to their preferences as possible. And if that means that someone is this, you know, midnight to 8 a.m. person, or heck, if they go to bed at 1 a.m. if that's their ideal and they sleep till 8 or they sleep till 9, you know, whatever their actual preference is, it would be ideal. And of course, ideal is not necessarily what everyone has access to, but it would be more ideal to try as close as possible to get behavior timings as close to your internal preferences as possible.
Right. Yeah. Just making sure. Yeah. Like you said, knowing yourself, knowing when you like to, you know, naturally fall asleep, wake up, you know, try to match that as best as you can.
Yeah.
There. So was there anything, so a couple, just kind of last questions here on this. Is there anything that maybe we missed on this topic that I didn't ask, or anything like that the audience should know about?
No, I guess it would also be to say that, like, you know, obsessing over sleep, like, the idea, we've obviously mentioned 8 hours a lot, but like, if someone's listening to this and they sleep 6 hours a night and they feel fine, you know, please do not go panicking that you think you need to add on an extra two. Like, it's, again, there's a lot of inter-individual variation with this. So if that's you and you sleep 6 hours and you're fine and you've got energy and you're not sluggish, you know, all of those metrics we would relate to sleep, then don't feel like you have to find an extra two somewhere. So yeah, I think, you know, just bear in mind your own kind of personal preferences within the sleep duration aspect as well. And what works for you is likely something that just works for you.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree with you. Yeah. Don't stress about, like, you know, getting 8 hours. Like, it, obviously that's probably a number we want to shoot for. But like you said, if you feel okay on 6-7 hours, it's like, hey, you know, that might just have to be as good as you can get, you know, for now, whether that's because of your time constraints or whatever it may be. So I guess to kind of leave the audience here with this, I know you kind of mentioned, you know, really trying to stay within that range of like what you feel is best for you in terms of when to fall asleep. But are there other any like practical applications here, whether that be, hey, this is kind of what we want to focus on sleep wise to help you get this lined up as best as you can. But also maybe, hey, you know, you just are somebody that, you know, this is going to be off a little bit. What are some things that you can like kind of do to help, you know, work around this?
Yeah. So the most potent influence on the circadian system, on our timing, is light. And so the uniform advice from any chronobiologist would be pay attention to your light exposure and environment. Natural light, even if it's gray, overcast, raining, natural light has a much greater intensity that you're exposed to than just the lights in your room or in your office. So as much as possible in the early part of the day, again, whenever that is for someone, as much as possible in the kind of 90 minutes to 2 hours after you're awake, try to get as much light, you know. And again, I've seen some recommendations that are just really impractical. So from a practical standpoint, I would say try and get at least 15 minutes of outdoor light exposure in that time. I've heard people say like 90 minutes. I'm like, who has time for that? Like, and also the people who make those recommendations seem to all live in Northern California. And I'm like, oh yeah, you can do this.
Right.
Right. So, you know, talk to me in Norway or something like that. So just get 15 minutes, if you can, in the first 2 hours of the day, natural light exposure. And then again, in the evening, just try to be mindful of light and screen time and stuff like that within maybe, you know, an hour before bed. And it's little simple things like that that I think can often make a difference in terms of sleep quality for some people.
Yeah, just getting out as early as you can. And, you know, like you said, getting some sunlight can be super helpful there. Also, maybe, you know, for somebody that is stressed about this now in terms of like, hey, during the week, I definitely, you know, my sleep changes because of, you know, whatever I have going on the weekend. Like, I guess, you know, maybe you do have an event one night and you have to stay up later than you normally do. Like, I'm sure if it happens every once in a while, it's not a big deal either. Like, you don't need to stress about one night. It's probably when this happens regularly that it starts to become a little bit more of an issue for people and for them to focus on it.
Yeah. So that's the other thing, is like social jet lag, certainly as we think of it now, appears to be a chronic exposure. And its effects are likely to be because of chronic social jet lag. I wouldn't assume that, you know, because you were at a wedding over the weekend and partied till 4 a.m. that you're now in the high social jet lag category and are never going to recover and are doomed to diabetes. So always, I think with all of these things, that this applies to any health behavior. It's like, it's really the law of averages and what you're doing kind of 80% of the time that add up. So I really wouldn't worry about stuff like this in an acute sense.
Well, cool, Alan.
It's very much a kind of a chronic exposure.
Awesome. Yeah. Sorry. Our internet here has been a little off, so there's a little lag in between. So if we've cut each other off, that's why. But no, a ton of great information here on social jet lag. I think this is going to help out a ton of people and at least give them more awareness around it. So great information. Before I let you go, is there anywhere where you'd like to lead the audience to, or anything coming up on your end that you want to let them know about?
I guess if we're on social media, I'm on Instagram at The Nutritional Advocate. That's the only social media platform I have. And they'll find my education hub at Alinea Nutrition. And then there's also the Sigma Nutrition podcast.
Awesome. Thank you, Alan. Again, great information, and appreciate you coming on the podcast today. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening. If you want more free content like this, follow me on Instagram at jeffh91_ or visit jhhealth.net. See you next time.